Good morning. This is the Groups 2 lecture. It's going to be a lot easier for you to follow this lecture if you do two things. One is to have downloaded the PowerPoint slides that are available on the website. I think you'll find that it goes a little easier if you can follow along with those. The other thing is, though we are living in a time of non-linearity, I think you'll have a much easier time listening to the Groups 2 lecture if you've actually listened to the Groups 1 lecture first. And of course, the reason you're listening to these lectures now is that they're in anticipation of your work in the group special occasion project, which you'll be doing fairly early in the class. So please download the PowerPoint slides if you haven't already, and listen to Groups 1 if you have not already. We've already talked about issues related to leadership and issues related to styles of leadership in the last lecture. I also want to mention one thing that I did not mention in the Groups 1 lecture, and that is, despite the fact that businesses are eager to use small groups and teamwork as a way of conducting business, it seems these days, ultimately, if those attempts fail, I would argue that it's not because the group communication itself is poor or because there's something inherently wrong with using teams or small groups, but rather businesses tend to jump into these kinds of activities without really giving their people, their members, any training in how to do these particular things. And unless you've had a course like this or unless you've had a minor in communication where you've actually studied small groups, this may be something that people do not come to naturally. And so I think that if you're a business, when you do adopt a team approach or if you do use a small group to solve a problem, please remember that those people need some sort of training. They need some of the information that we're talking about in these lectures in order to function effectively and lead small groups. Okay. As I said, we're going to begin today by talking a bit about the stages of group development. And here what we're talking about is the question of whether or not there is some kind of predictable set of steps that a small group goes through as it's attempting to solve, say, a particular problem. Much of the research that was done in this area was actually done on ad hoc problem-solving groups, and ad hoc means that they were temporary, right? They were formed for the purpose of solving a particular problem, and after that problem has been solved or after that group has reported back with its information, it dissolves. And what was very interesting to a lot of different researchers was whether or not there was something predictable about the stages that a group went through. And though there's been a lot of research that's been done in this area, there's some general consensus. There are some general agreement among the various researchers. Unfortunately, they all tend to use different names for the stages that they talk about. So even today, though your book uses a slightly different set of terms, I'm going to introduce you to a set of terms for the stages that most researchers have found that small groups go through. The first stage is called the forming stage. And the forming stage is exactly what it sounds like. It's among the first meetings of a small group. And what's really happening in this particular time period is that people are trying to get to know one another. These are the folks that they have been tasked to work with. They've been told that this small group is going to solve a particular problem over a particular time frame. And so one of the first things you want to do is figure out what other people's motives are. What resources or expertise do they bring to this small group so that ultimately you can work together with these folks? During this stage of the proceeding, you may not have even picked a leader at this point, and ultimately what you're trying to do is mostly related to the socio-emotional orientation. People are chatting about one another. People are trying to get to know and be introduced to one another. And so there may not be much that's actually happening in terms of the task orientation of the group, that is the specific goal that they're supposed to be solving, but please don't underestimate this stage as not being important to the group's functioning, because it is. And I think people who plan meetings have begun to recognize that one of the reasons you provide coffee and donuts at the beginning of the meeting and give your folks, you know, 15 minutes to chat is they're going to want to do this. It is a predictable and natural part of a meeting. The second stage that most folks who research in this area identify, again, it goes by different names, but I'm going to use the name storming. So we've got forming, then storming. And storming is the stage at which there is a lot of conflict over who may be leading the group, or what the goals are for the group, or the means that a group is going to use to get to a particular goal. There's a lot of conflict that can happen, and that needs to be productively managed. We're going to have a lecture later in the semester about conflict management and how to get people to agree even when they seem to be disagreeable. But ultimately, again, you're not going to maybe have very much happening in terms of the specific task orientation, but people are going to have to work through with each other with as much goodwill as they possibly can to settle on issues of who's going to lead the group, what their specific goal is, and then how they're going to accomplish it. And again, that's a very important function for a group to work through. It may not have any specific relationship to getting the task done, but it's the necessary precondition for getting those tasks done. The third step that we see in this kind of stages of group development, and I think you're getting to see a pattern here, right? It's beginning to rhyme. We've got forming, storming, and then the third step is called norming. That is, people are establishing norms. People are beginning to understand the ways in which they interact with one another on the group. They know certain topics to bring up and other topics maybe not so effective to be talking about. People are beginning to understand their roles. The leader is getting more comfortable with her position in the group and the way in which the group likes to be run. So in this stage, the third stage, it may be the first point at which you're actually getting more work done than you are being sociable. That is, we could say this more formally by saying that the task orientation of the small group begins to exceed the socio-emotional orientation for the group. People are beginning to get stuff done. The fourth step, and again, we're going to continue the pattern of rhyming. We've had forming, storming, norming, and then the fourth level is called performing. Right? This is when a group really begins to hit on all cylinders. People have learned their roles. People understand how to get together and how to work with one another and how to manage conflicts effectively, and they understand how to kind of get the work done. This is the level that you hope your group will get to, and you hope it'll get to that quickly. But you have to understand that you have to work your way usually through these other three stages to get to the fourth stage of performing. Some research ends at that point, saying performing is the natural conclusion of the group. But many others, and I would agree with them, want to add a fifth step. And it doesn't quite rhyme with the others, but it's called adjourning. Like in the same way that you adjourn a meeting, this final stage of a group and its life together is the point at which, at this point, things become more socio-emotional. If the group has been working hard over the last couple of weeks, it may be rather celebratory. It may be a chance to celebrate the hard work that you've done, a chance to celebrate the conclusion of the meetings. And even if there's only 10 minutes at a meeting taken for this stage, it's an important part because I think people want to feel good about their relationship to the group. They want to feel good about the time that they've put in and the work that they've done on a particular project. And one of the ways you honor that as a group, and one of the ways that leaders have to think about honoring that, is to give the chance for the group to actually come together at the end and celebrate what they've done. In the group that I led in the early 1990s on campus to rate particular programs on campus, where I was the junior member and I was pretty committed to just providing facilitative leadership, one of the things that I insisted on is at the end of our meeting throughout the summer, where we worked really, really hard, is that we have a moment where we have a meeting at the end, where we come together to all sign the final report, when we're all signing off on the fact that, you know, here's this 40 or 50 page document that we've been able to put together. And it's a chance for people to say goodbye and to congratulate one another. Please don't underestimate that as an important part of group development. Now, the interesting thing as well about this research on stages of group development is that some authors have theorized that in addition to describing the ways in which a group changes over a long period of time, for instance, if you've got an ad hoc problem-solving group that meets over a period of 3 months every once a week, you could see these different stages happen over the life cycle of the group. But there are some people who argue, and I tend to believe them, that these stages of group development may even be important for individual group meetings. Think about what happens at the average meeting that you might go to. The forming stage is when people come in and they're talking to their buddies, finding out what they did over the weekend, whether or not they caught any fish, whether or not the kid got a hit in Little League. Ultimately, those kinds of questions are sociable, and they're about getting ready to get to do your work. Storming may be a phase early in the meeting where you might have disagreements about what they're going to try to accomplish, or if somebody is not in attendance at the meeting, whether or not they could go forward with the agenda as planned. Eventually, you get on to norming and figuring out that you're going to get your work done, performing, you end up kind of hitting on all cylinders. And then at the end of each meeting, right, isn't there this moment where people discuss when the next meeting is, who's going to be responsible for typing up the minutes to the meeting, who's going to be responsible for bringing the coffee and bagels to the next meeting? Those kinds of things are important. They shouldn't be underestimated. You want to remember to leave time for them at the end of a meeting. So in any event, I think that these stages of group development are interesting and informative for people who want to understand how to make sure that groups are working well, because they inform us not only over the life of a small group, how what the stages are that people are going to be involved in, but even within individual meetings, there are these kind of stages to look for as people do their work. Okay. I'm going to move on to a topic that is mentioned, well, only really briefly in your textbook, but I think it's very important, not only because it helps to explain some very significant issues in American history, but it's even relevant to this very day as you look at what's happening on the political scene. And I don't mean to make this a political class, and even though I'm going to use some examples from the current administration, believe me, when I tell you I would be using these examples whether the administration was Democrat or Republican, I just want to kind of make this a little more real by not just leaving it in the realm of recent American history from the 1960s. The concept that I want to talk about is a potential negative to dealing with small groups and the way in which they make decisions. It was coined by an MIT professor by the name of Irving Janis, and it's called groupthink. One word, groupthink. And really, it helps to explain what can happen when groups go bad and why they do go bad. But let me give you a little bit of historical background to the work that Janis did and what he was looking at. And it really involved two very important foreign policy issues that happened during the early parts of the Kennedy administration in the early 1990s. When John F. Kennedy came to power as a Democrat in 1961, one of the first things that his opponents questioned him on and what Democrats were vulnerable to was whether or not they were going to be soft on communism. This was the time of the Cold War where it was very much a bilateral world of the U.S. versus the old Soviet Union. And one of the things that the Kennedy administration was very interested in making sure that everybody understood was that they were going to be tough on communism. And of course, if you're going to try and be tough on communism and you want to demonstrate that, one of the opportunities that presented itself to them very early in the administration was the problem of Fidel Castro in Cuba. Cuba was about 90 miles off the mainland. Here was this homegrown communist leader, Fidel Castro, who had come to power, who had worked its way through a revolution that seemed to be popularly based, but who ultimately set himself up as a client state for the Soviet Union with very close ties. And people in Washington were obviously nervous about having a communist regime so close to its shores, just 90 miles off of Miami. And so one of the things that was hatched, a plot was hatched to try and restore a democratic government in Cuba in a way of overthrowing Fidel Castro. And the CIA hatched a plan where they would essentially train and equip a couple of hundred former Cuban residents, people who had left Cuba after Fidel Castro came to power. They were very much anti-communists, and they were going to be deposited on the shores of Cuba. And the thinking, at least the intelligence that was coming out of the CIA at the time, was that if they could get a foothold there in Cuba, that because they thought that Castro was not in fact a popular leader, that the people really didn't believe in his revolution, that the people would stream out into the streets and support these liberators, these kind of anti-communists who had been set ashore, and that the they would be able to overthrow Castro. And this would be a great moment of success for democracy. It would be a great moment for the Kennedy administration. Well, of course, best laid plans and all, this proved to be one of the first and foremost disasters of the Kennedy administration. They landed these folks on Cuba. It turned out that this was not a secret at all, that there were plenty of folks who knew that this was going to happen. When these folks landed on the island in a place called the Bay of Pigs, and hence the name for the whole fiasco, when they landed in the Bay of Pigs, there was no general uproar and streaming out into the streets to support these folks. These folks were landed with light munitions, and they were immediately kind of outgunned by the Fidel-led forces. And ultimately, these people were defeated rather quickly. A lot of people died. A lot of people went to jail. But most importantly, it was a huge propaganda boon for Fidel Castro because he had been able to beat back this invading force of infidels sponsored by the great Satan, the United States. And so here in its first real attempt to try and get this to work, it turned out to be a horribly planned, perfect disaster for the Kennedy administration. And when you ask, well, geez, how could this have happened? How could they have been so wrong? One of the things that Janus began to look at is the kind of advice that Kennedy was getting and the people that he surrounded himself with in his cabinet. And he began to develop this theory of group decision-making that suggested that if you surround yourself with too many people who think exactly like you on important causes, and you all think you're pretty smart, and you all think that God is on your side, that you may be running the risk of really horribly botching whatever it is you're working on because of something, a syndrome that he called groupthink. What were the characteristics of groupthink? Well, you can see there on your PowerPoint slide, and it is discussed a bit in your textbook. Some of the problems related to groupthink. You get an illusion of invulnerability that essentially you can do no wrong. Now, in the Kennedy administration, when Kennedy swept in, he surrounded himself with a lot of folks from Harvard University, with a lot of folks from other Ivy League schools. At the time, these folks were thought to be the kind of best and the brightest, but they'd also led them to thinking that whatever they came up with was ultimately right, because how could they be wrong? They were invulnerable. There was a seeming sense of unanimity among the group. When this was brought up, nobody seemed to really speak out against it. Now, oddly enough, if you look at the memoirs of some of the people who were in the original Kennedy cabinet when the Bay of Pigs invasion was being decided, when you look at the planning group, a number of these folks who later wrote memoirs, the little weasels, they kind of said, well, at the time I had grave doubts about whether or not this entire project was going to work. Oh, good. So here you are, an advisor to the President of the United States, and you've chosen to keep those doubts to yourself because it's more important to appear to go along with the team than to really give your leader the kind of advice that he or she needs. I think this is a horrible disservice, and any of these folks who kind of later weaseled out and said they didn't think this was really going to work kind of shows you how powerful it can be to appear loyal, to want to appear unanimous with the other folks in the group. The other sense of illusion comes from group morality, the notion that, well, God is on our side. We have to be right. They have to be wrong. And the result is, how could we fail? When groups begin to adopt this kind of attitude, you begin to get into a position where groupthink takes over. Among the other things that happen related to groupthink is self-censorship. That is, as information begins to flow to the group, what tends to happen is that information that does not square with the positions already taken by the group is either screened out by the members of the group or never reaches the group because it seemed to be information that would be incompatible with the thinking of the people in that area. So rather than give them evidence that could be later converted into an interpretation of events that might more accurately reflect what was going on, you tend to only get information that confirms the previous positions of the group. And so that kind of self-separate censorship may happen through members of the group, or it may happen from the people who normally provide information to that group. Rather than appear to be providing information that would disconfirm what's going on, people never speak up at all. The groups like these begin to share particular stereotypes about the people that they work with or against, and they begin to screen, as I've said, under self-censorship, adverse information that would tend to somehow disrupt their view of reality. The result is that you get a situation where, though you've got a group of really smart people in the room trying to give advice to a CEO or a president, you get really, really bad advice because they're all suffering from groupthink. Now, again, I said before at the beginning of this that I didn't want to make this political, and I don't want this to be seen as an exercise in bashing the Bush administration, but even a Republican-led Senate intelligence report in 2005 argued that one of the reasons we went to war in Iraq was that in 2002 and 2003, the Bush administration's highest advisors had developed a serious problem with groupthink, where they were not getting adverse information, where they begun to think that they were completely invulnerable, that the war would be over quickly, that we would be greeted as liberators, that all would go well, that there was no reason to plan for a post-Iraq scenario because we would be in and out so quickly that there wouldn't have to be an occupying force. This was a report that came out of a Republican-led Senate Intelligence Committee. So this is not just, you know, Democratic politics as usual, trying to, rein on the leadership. This is from a Republican-controlled body making an argument, trying to find out why this happened. Now, just because it was groupthink doesn't mean that there weren't people responsible, because though Irving Janis had identified this as a problem in the Kennedy administration, the thing that really sealed it for him was to watch what happened just a couple of years later when the Kennedy administration was faced with another very serious foreign policy challenge, and that was that the Soviet Union had decided to deploy offensive nuclear weapons in Cuba, 90 miles from the shores of America. The United States defense planners knew that this was a potentially intolerable situation. The problem is that if you've got nuclear missiles only 20 miles from your, or 90 miles from your shore, if you decide to launch an offensive nuclear attack, those missiles will reach your shores and either your population centers or your missiles that you're waiting to kind of shoot yourself, they'll reach them before you even made the decision to deploy or shoot off your own missiles. And the result is that you have a very destabilized world that's characterized by the kind of catchy phrase, use them or lose them. American defense planners were very concerned that they would have their own missiles taken out in their silos. And so what you have is a world where instead of launching when you know a nuclear strike has been confirmed, you launch when the launch is confirmed. And so if you believe the Soviets have shot off missiles at you, Americans have to turn around and shoot off their missiles before they even know if the attack is a real one or whether it's just a computer glitch. You've probably all seen War Games with Matthew Broderick, so you know what I'm talking about here. But it was a real problem. And Graham Allison, Irving Janis, was continuing to study the kind of decision-making that went on. And ultimately, the Kennedy administration seems to have made all the right moves when it came to the Cuban Missile Crisis, because they were able to essentially demand that Khrushchev remove the missiles. They did so because they set up what they called a quarantine, not a blockade, but a quarantine. Interesting use of a medical metaphor there, to essentially blockade Cuba. At the time, Cuba was very dependent on materiel being sent from the Soviet Union. They really couldn't survive by themselves. And so if the United States was able to actually turn back ships from the Soviet Union that were bound for Cuba, it would be a real problem. Depending on whose history of this event that you read, the American history says that what happened is that Khrushchev blinked. Khrushchev ultimately responded to the Americans by removing the missiles, and a very tense moment in world history, a moment that Graham Allison, who was another professor at MIT, estimated that the chances of all-out nuclear war that October in 1962, there was a 1 in 3 chance of all-out nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union. 1 in 3. It's actually pretty frightening to think about. But in this case, it seems like Kennedy got really good advice. Generals in the Pentagon had wanted to actually send the B-52s to essentially bomb the missiles in Cuba before they could actually be deployed. The Kennedy administration chose not to do that, and that was really kind of good because the Soviets had made it clear that if we were to bomb their missiles before they were deployed, that they would take that as an act of war and they would start shooting nukes from where they were inside the Soviet Union. So ultimately, using this blockade or using this quarantine metaphor that was ultimately adopted seemed to have been exactly the right way to defuse this. How could it that the Kennedy administration made such good decisions on the Cuban Missile Crisis when just a year before they seemed to make such horrible decisions related to the Bay of Pigs? And the answer is they seem to have adopted some of the things that Janice talks about that prevented groupthink in order to make better decisions. So if you turn over to the next slide about solving groupthink, Janice there offers six ways that people, that CEOs, that anybody who leads a group can attempt to minimize the problem of groupthink. And think about this in terms of, if you'd like, because we're using this as a real-world example not to bash the Bush administration. Think about this in terms of whether or not the Bush administration has acted effectively to try and solve the problem of groupthink that even a Republicanly led Senate committee has suggested existed in the planning up to the beginning of the Iraq War. Janice says one of the first things that you can do is appoint a devil's advocate. If you're not familiar with that term, what that means is essentially to have a member giving you advice who simply takes the opposing point of view just for the purposes of spurring on discussion, just so that you can talk about the alternatives. So, was there anybody in the room prior to the start of the war in Iraq saying, hey, what about if there are no WMDs? Or what about if it's not really the way the information that we're getting, it turns out to be that way? What if the war lasts longer than 6 weeks? If you don't have somebody speaking out and attempting for making you grapple with the opposing point of view, you may just follow a headlong rush to your previously conceived notions that all is well. A second note here on the PowerPoint slide is that leaders should learn to stay impartial as you're discussing various policy options, right? If the leader tips her hand, if the leader says, I'm in favor of policy X, it probably won't be too much of a surprise to say that the discussion that will ensue in that small group will tend to confirm that policy X is the best thing to do, that there may not be serious discussion given to other alternative policies because the leader has already spoken his or her mind. If the leader stays impartial, if the leader does not tip his or her hand, then it's more likely that various factions within the small group will help to argue through the various policies that are out there more fairly because they're not just trying to please the boss, they're actually trying to get to the good policy. A third step is something that we actually use at our department. And that is to allow for what are called second chance meetings. And the notion is pretty simple. It simply says that when we're going to take a major policy step in our department, it's required to be discussed first and then talked about during a first meeting, but not actually voted on finally until we do a second meeting at another time. We do that because it gives us a chance to pause, to think about the policy action that we're about to take place, to engage in what we kind of normally call hall talk, where informally members of the faculty get together and talk about various policies that are being considered. And this allows us to avoid making a mistake on, you know, acting with little information or acting without a point of view that hadn't already been heard. A second chance meeting allows for more time built into the system so that you don't rush headlong into a very bad mistake. The fourth note there on the PowerPoint slide talks about inviting comments from outside experts or trusted associates. Now remember, in the original Kennedy administration, at least when they were making the Bay of Pigs decision, these people were the best of the best. I mean, after all, these were pointy-headed Harvard PhDs. Who could have been trusted to come in and tell them that there was another point of view? It might be hard to figure. But ultimately, if you're a CEO and you're using groups and you're using teams to make decisions, in order to make sure that they are not frozen up by groupthink, you might want to ask them to consult with outside folks, to bring in outside experts, to try and give them additional information and points of view that they may not have been privy to before. And you want to make sure it's somebody that they would respect. If you bring in some outsider that they simply regard as a goofball, if you bring in somebody that does not have the credentials that you think are appropriate, it's very easy for that group to simply dismiss those people as not as smart as the team is. And you don't want that to happen. So it's got to be something that even the people within the team would trust and respect. A fifth a way to prevent groupthink from happening, from Irving Janis, is to think about subdividing tasks. That is, break off into working groups, even to the point where you're allowing people to work on what could be contradictory kinds of actions, and then come back together, have a meeting, and see which of those actions seems most logical to you. When you have little groups working on particular points, it's less likely that this groupthink is going to take hold because you can set things up so that they don't run headlong into a mistake. A final issue, and this is one that certainly any policy-making textbook is going to tell you is a really important thing. Don't let the people who plan organizational change or come up with solutions to a problem, don't let that small group who created the solution also be the one who evaluates whether or not that solution was successful. This may sound really obvious to us now, sitting outside of a group, not within the context of a small group meeting, but let me tell you, this mistake is made all the time. You need to have somebody else go in and evaluate whether or not something worked, because what is a group going to do? Of course, the group is going to say, oh, our brilliant idea was implemented beautifully and things are going smoothly, when in fact things may be going to hell. And so it's really important that you give a different set of folks the charge of evaluating whether or not organizational change worked, somebody different from the groups who actually planned and initially implemented the changes. And so those six things are really the beginning of ways to deal with the problem of groupthink. Now, unfortunately, if you think of what happened with the Bush administration after the 2004 elections, right? So here we have these charges that there was this terrible groupthink that was controlling the Bush administration and its rush, essentially, to invade Iraq. Ultimately, what you would hope would happen is that there would be a shakeup in the second administration. You'd bring in some new points of view. You'd bring in some people who'd be willing to play devil's advocate to speak up against what it is the administration wanted to do, if only for the academic exercise to prove them wrong. But that, of course, didn't happen. Instead, what happened is, you look at the changes that Bush made in his cabinet after 2004's election, is he essentially hunkered down and he stayed with the people who had been loyal to him all along. Trade places with a few folks. He got rid of one of the few voices of dissent within his first administration. Colin Powell was essentially allowed to resign and let go and was replaced by a person who was even closer to the president and even less likely to give a dissenting point of view. Unfortunately, I think that if the Bush administration had been a little clearer about what was involved with the possibilities of groupthink and thinking about how these important foreign policy decisions were made, we might have had some very different outcomes. Again, this may be a simplistic way of thinking about what happened here, but when even a Senate Intelligence Committee is able to identify groupthink as part of the problem within the administration, and no steps had really been taken to solve this, no way in which dissenting voices might be heard at a higher level of the government, it does not bode well, I don't think. And unfortunately, we have all this information in front of us right now to do better. The last part of this lecture is really geared towards talking about some of the structural strategic ways in which groups can actually work to make decisions. Some of these you may be familiar with, some of these may be relatively unfamiliar to you, but ultimately what we're talking about here is the structures that any good leader can put their group through in order to make good decisions. Let me talk about a first one because probably most people have heard this before. It's called brainstorming, and I'm going to discuss both the rules of brainstorming and some of the uses for it. The first thing is to understand that what brainstorming works for and what it doesn't work for. It works for the process of inquiry, of trying to find stuff out, of being creative, of generating lists of proposals, of thinking about different ways of attacking problems. It is not a good process for evaluating those particular processes. So it's used very specifically at a point in a group's life when what they're trying to do is to come up with a large number of possible options. Brainstorming is really a free-flowing time where a group is allowed to generate, let's say for instance that the group was trying to solve parking problems on campus. And what you would do in a brainstorming opportunity to work with that group is to say, okay, there are some rules here for the next kind of few minutes as we brainstorm this issue. And among those rules, you would want to tell them the most important thing is that there should be absolutely no negative feedback or evaluation when a member of the group puts out an idea. You don't want to hear people in the background saying, oh, that's stupid, or what would you expect from somebody from accounting, or that's the dumbest idea I've heard in 30 years. Any of those kinds of comments, or even nonverbal comments like people rolling their eyes, or you get a kind of an exasperated sigh, that's absolutely not productive, and it inhibits the free flow of ideas. And that's why as a leader it's really important in a brainstorming exercise that you tell people that they should not be providing any negative feedback at this time. You want to tell the group that you're striving for a quantity of ideas. Set a completely unrealistic number, like, okay, in the next 5 minutes I want to come up with 25 possible solutions to the parking problem here at Sac State. That may sound ridiculous. It may sound like it's too many to do in 5 minutes, but you may also find that by striving for quantity, people will begin to think in creative ways. Striving for creativity is really what it's all about. Because they're not being negatively evaluated, tell people this is the time to suggest something that maybe we've never done before. This is the time to do something outlandish. This is the time to think outside of the box. You need to encourage your group members to think creatively. And then finally, you want to encourage what's called piggybacking. That does not mean that you get people on each other's shoulders and kind of roust about in the meeting room. When we're talking about piggybacking, we're talking about people creatively combining various suggestions, maybe from other people, into something different. So an example of piggybacking would be when somebody says, you know, I like that idea that Jose came up with, but if you combined it with what Maria was talking about earlier, that would really give us a solution that would do this, this, and this, right? So it's a creative combination of ideas from other people. Nobody really owns ideas in these kind of sessions. Nobody owns options. And so the idea to combine them creatively, there's no copyright, right, on these particular ideas, and it gives you a chance for creative combination. Again, brainstorming is probably something we think we all know how to do. We've talked about using it in groups. You know, you've probably done it in classes. But again, the important thing is if you're going to use brainstorming, you want to make sure it's used for an appropriate kind of enterprise where you're trying to generate lists or you're trying to inquire as to the nature of a problem, they're not good for evaluation. And the most important element in brainstorming is to warn the members of the group not to engage in any kind of negative feedback or evaluation, because once you get stepped on, once you get shouted down in a meeting, once somebody humiliates you for making a suggestion, it's unlikely you're going to speak up again and risk what you're doing in that meeting. So it's important to stop that negative feedback. A second group technique for problem solving that you see there on the next slide is called the nominal group technique. And it's a very well-named technique because even though it's a group technique for problem solving, even though it's something that you would use with teams, actually a lot of the work that happens in this group happens with people working individually, right? So let's explain. Again, let's put ourselves in a situation where there are five people in the room and you have been tasked with ways for, let's say, raising money for the university. That's the job that you've got to come up with. The first thing that you would do in a nominal group technique is tell the people who are in the group that they are going to silently generate, say, five ideas for raising money for the university. That's the thing they're going to do. So they're working by themselves. Even though there's five people sitting in the same room, they work individually. The next step of the nominal group technique is where the leader begins to record publicly the options, solutions, suggestions, or ideas that the group has come up with. But you do this in round-robin fashion. That is, you go to the first person, then you go to the second person, the third person, the fourth person, around the room until you've exhausted all of the ideas that have been generated by these people. You don't give the first person a chance to dump all 5 or 6 or 10 or 15 of their ideas, because what they're really doing is taking the thunder away from the other people in the room. Go round robin and say, okay, you give me your best idea, then you give me your best idea, and so on around the room until everybody has a chance to exhaust all of their various ideas. Once you have all these ideas recorded up on a bulletin board, up on a blackboard, on a flip chart, wherever it is, you go through each idea not to criticize, but rather to help the other members of the group understand what it is you meant when you made that suggestion. So this is a round in which you're simply clarifying, you are not evaluating. Okay, so that way everybody has the same information level as it obtains to these particular different sets of options that are there on your desktop, that are there on your flip chart, wherever it is. Actually, I'd love to do this on one of those kind of computer-generated whiteboards where you can actually record on the whiteboard, and then through optical character recognition or whatever software they use, they actually make copies of this in a computer file. It's kind of a cool thing. I've never gotten to work with that technology, but I'm looking forward to that in the future. Anyway, so we're at the point where people now seem to understand what these different options are. The next step, and I can't give you the exact elements here because it really depends on the number of people in the group, the number of ideas that you're looking at. But what you're going to do is essentially have a vote where each member gets to select their five favorites, say, from this group of 25. And you go through the folks and say, okay, give me your five, tell me which of these five you think are the best. And you record, little hash marks next to their favorites. And you go through the entire room and you get everybody's vote. And at the end of that, you should have the beginnings of a consensus, right? There should be some options or suggestions that attracted more attention than others. You may have some that have absolutely no support at all. So you'd go through the list of 25, and you might eliminate all of the ones that either have one vote or no votes, and maybe that gets you down to 16. And then you can say, okay, one more round of clarification so that we know what we're talking about. I want you to next time vote for only your two favorite solutions or your two favorite options here. You have another round of voting, and what you're going to begin to do is you'll begin to kind of clarify for the group which of these various options have the most support. And it's a way of kind of bringing the group kind of down the road to consensus. Once you've been able to kind of do your second round of voting, you should have a few suggestions that are dominant, a few that have garnered the most votes. That might be the best place to start as you then proceed to kind of go through and narrow even further. So nominal group technique is really effective at both getting equal participation from everybody in the group, right? If you have people who are normally reticent, if you have people who don't speak up, or if you have extreme power differentials in the group where you've got the executive vice president and you've got somebody just at the lowest levels of the organization, in order to maximize and give equal participation to everybody, the nominal group technique is a great way to do that because that it prevents people from dominating the discussion because it asks people to kind of work individually first and then kind of work in such a way that nobody can dominate the discussion. So nominal group technique, I think it's something that everybody has to really have in their back pocket and really understand how to use. The next kind of problem-solving format I have called traditional problem-solving. It's really based on the work of John Dewey, who was an educational philosopher who was writing primarily at the early part of the 20th century, so a lot of his publications came out during the 1920s. But he's a very well-respected theorist in education, and he argued that there was actually a way to kind of solve problems as a group that was the most logical, was the way that reflected the way in which we really make decisions, and which really gave us whatever advantages we might have from working in small groups. Whether you call it traditional problem solving, whether you call it reflective thinking, it's possible that Adler even uses a different kind of a name for this. This is a very solid, logical way of structuring your group's discussion on problem solving or trying to figure out how to solve the issue that's been presented to you in your team at work. Okay, if you look there at the kind of six steps, I think you'll find that they're very logical. The other thing is that this is very linear. What that means is that you have to do step one before you get to step two, before you get to step three, and so on. So it's very linear, but because it is linear, it will really give your group work structure. It will allow everybody to see logically where you're going. And so there are a lot of reasons to prefer this kind of traditional problem-solving mode. The first step that Dewey says that you really need to work on is defining the problem. Lay out for people exactly what it is you're talking about. And then the second step, which goes along with that, it's really important, and that is to research and analyze the problem. Because people may say, we have this problem of poverty in the United States, but we may not understand or be saying the same thing. We may be saying that, oh, there's poverty, there's a lot of poor people. Other people may be thinking there's poverty because there's a lot of unemployed people. Other people may be saying there's a lot of poverty because our system is set up to keep people poor at some level. A lot of different perspectives, even though we're using the same language. It's really important to get in there and research and analyze the problem so that we know exactly what it is we're talking about. We have stronger agreement about the nature of the problem itself. The third step, before you even begin to talk about ways to solve problems, is to establish criteria for the solution of this problem. And within a business context, this can be really important. Because you may have this terrible problem facing your business. You've got horrible rates of turnover, right? Couple of 100%. That is, you generally can't keep people in the same job for more than, you know, 3 or 4 months, and then you're hiring new people all the time. And that can be a terrible problem for a small business or even a large business. But in solving that problem, you have to understand that there are some criteria that your group is going to have to work with. I mean, obviously, one way to keep people in jobs is to pay them a ridiculously high amount of money. That may solve one problem, but it may obviously create a lot of others. And it would be intolerable for a business or an organization to simply say, yes, we're simply going to pay the people at the lowest level of the organizational chart $55,000 a year, because then we'll be able to solve the turnover problem. That creates other problems within the organization that they really couldn't tolerate. So establish criteria for solutions. how long will it take to implement it? At what level of solvency, that is, how much of the problem does your solution need to solve? If it even carves off a little bit of the problem, is that acceptable? Or does it have to essentially solve all of the problem before you're going to implement something like that? Once you've established the various criteria for solutions, you then go through the step of listing possible alternatives or solutions. Now, this is where it gets interesting. You could actually use brainstorming at this stage of the process, or you could use nominal group technique at this stage of the process embedded within traditional problem solving, because this step is a step of inquiry. It's a step of listing or suggesting possible problems. Looking for solutions. So this is something where you can actually embed other parts of traditional problem solving with brainstorming or nominal group technique. Once you've listed those problems, it's your job to lead your group through evaluating each alternative. And what you're really doing here is you're measuring the solutions that have come up against the criteria that you've already established, even before you started talking about solutions. That's very important in order to have an honest discussion. If you are working on the criteria at the same time you're looking at the solutions, you're going to get, I think, a biased discussion. If you've established the criteria first, then everybody knows kind of what's the standard here, and then you can move forward. Finally, you want to select the best alternative, the one that meets closest to the criteria. It's within budget. It can be implemented within present resources. It can be implemented within the next 3 months. Whatever the important criteria are, you find the solution that works best against those criteria. For novice group leaders, having something like a traditional problem-solving format can be extremely effective because it will give you confidence that you know how the process is going to proceed. It will give you the confidence of leading your group through the various stages of discussion to get to the point where you get your work done. I think that can be a very important part because I think your group takes your cue from you. You can only be a confident leader if you have some knowledge of these kinds of decision-making structures that happen within small groups, that happen within teams. And so again, in talking about these different structures for problem solving, I really think that good managers, good leaders, folks who are effective organizational participants have a real repertoire of some of these different problem-solving formats, because that's the best way that you can then draw on what works in the particular scenario, the particular situation, the particular environment in which you are working. I have one final format that I want to talk about. So it looks like this lecture is not going to go much over 60 minutes. That's fine because I probably pressed you a little long on the first part of group one. But in any event, the final one I want to talk about is called the Delphi technique. And this actually has a very specific purpose for a very specific kind of situation. Imagine, if you will, you were leading a national organization, but that organization was built ultimately on sales. Let's say you were selling widgets, okay? And you only make money as a company when your salespeople are out in the field selling widgets. If you aren't selling any widgets, you aren't making any money. And so when you have your annual national sales convention, it really makes sense to do a lot of pre-planning. Because if you're pulling your sales force out of the field for 3 days or for a full week so that everybody can come to corporate headquarters, you want to make very good use of that time. You don't want to be in a situation where those people show up and you all kind of look at each other and say, so what do we do now? Or why are we here? Or what are we trying to accomplish? And what happens is the Delphi technique essentially allows that to happen before the meeting actually starts. In some ways, it could be looked at almost as nominal group technique on a very large scale. So, everybody clear now on what Delphi technique is used for. It's used essentially for pre-planning meetings. And what happens is this. You would, let's say again, we're in the context of this national sales convention, and you're really interested in trying to figure out what are the barriers to greater sales that your salespeople have come to find. If you think about who has information on this within an organization, it's probably not the people at the, you know, corporate suites. It's probably not your national sales manager. The people with the best information about why they're not selling more widgets are probably the people who are in the field. And so the first thing you would do as this process of Delphi goes forward would be to collect from the participants in this meeting that's coming up their ideas for why it is there are barriers for selling more widgets. Okay, maybe it's that the widgets are poorly priced. Maybe there are quality control programs. Maybe they're not competitive with other widgets made by other corporations out in the workplace. There may be lots of reasons. Maybe there's not good training of the sales staff. Maybe they're not given the right materials for doing their sales pitches for the people who are out there trying to buy widgets. There may be tons of different reasons. Maybe it's the compensation plan, right? If the compensation plan rewards salespeople for continuing to mine old accounts, that may be a problem as to why there's not a lot of new business, because there's no financial incentive for new business in the way the compensation plan is structured. Whatever the reasons, you go out to your membership and you say, give us some ideas of what are barriers to you selling more widgets. You would essentially collect all that information, and then you would send a list back out to each participant and ask them to rate on a scale which you think are the most legitimate and important barriers to increasing sales, and which ones do you think are less important or illegitimate. And you have them rank those particular ideas. The information comes back into the main office, and you then have people who are looking at the responses, and they see if there are threads that kind of hang together. Do you see connections between these various problems that are out there? And can they be more broadly defined? So it could be if you've got a list of 100 different barriers, that in fact numbers 12, 15, 35, 42, and 75 are really all related to better training and development for your better training for your salespeople. Okay, if that's the case, that becomes one of the kind of generally agreed upon problems. So this leader is creating a master list from these participants after they kind of go through and think about all these things. And then what happens is the participants vote on issues on a master list that's been prepared. So let's say you've been able to synthesize 100 different possible problems down into 10. You then have the people coming to this sales conference vote again on which of the 10 you think are most important. And maybe it comes down to 3 where there was general agreement that these were the most important. Then, on the day that you actually have your salespeople come in from the field to attend the national sales meeting, you can already have 3 different areas or task forces that the individual salespeople can identify and say, yes, I want to go and talk about compensation plans and with the people who are concerned about that and with the administrators who are involved in creating the compensation plans, because I think if we can get that right, you can create the right financial motives to get your salespeople to sell the way you want them to sell. Let's say there's another task force that's based around training of salespeople. And every time there's a new style of widget, why don't we hear about it first? Why aren't we given the training to understand what the advantages of the new widgets are? Those matters could be taken up in the task force on training. Okay? And you then give people opportunities. So, maybe those task force would meet, in the first day. On the second day, you'd have, again, the same task forces, but you'd have people rotate through and give them a chance to really talk about each of the important issues. At the end of your time there, you would then bring people all together in what's called a plenary session, P-L-E-N-A-R-Y, plenary session, where you can have reports from the various groups about ways to solve the problems that these members have identified. So the advantage of Delphi, see, it's kind of like nominal group technique because people do a lot of the work individually, but what it means is when they come to your national sales meeting, they have done a lot of work already, and they are really hitting the ground running. They're not wasting any time. You can't afford to have those salespeople out of the field for very long, because if they're not in the field selling widgets, nobody's making any money. And so Delphi Technique is really a tool for pre-planning conferences in such a way that you maximize input from the participants who are coming to that conference, so that when they hit the ground, when that conference starts, they've already helped to engage in a lot of the planning that's going to make that conference a meaningful kind of situation. So again, though Delphi is specialized, though it won't be used very much, it can be extremely important in the situations where it is appropriate. So what we've tried to do today is we tried to talk a little bit about the various stages of group development and how people who are planning or leading groups need that information to understand how their group is proceeding or how it works through in an individual particular meeting. We've talked about some of the problems, again, related to making decisions in groups, particularly groupthink, and how we attempt to kind of manage that problem, and how you can build into your organization ways to make sure that groupthink does not seize up, that it does not reach, take control of your organization. One only wonders whether or not really big organizations like the federal government, like the Bush administration, might have taken advantage of this kind of information. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem they've done it. And then finally, some various specific formats for doing group problem solving: the Delphi technique, the reflective thinking model or traditional problem solving, nominal group technique, and brainstorming. I think these should be part of every leader's repertoire. It should be a part of every organizational member's repertoire, so that if you do have to work in teams, if you do have to ultimately participate in a meaningful way, you've got some of this information. And if you are involved in a business, if you are involved in a large organization that's expecting hard work to be done among members of your organization in team formats, in small groups, please, it's really important that you give them some training, some of the kind of information that we've talked about in these last two lectures, prior to expecting them to function well in a small group setting. Because this is not stuff that people come to naturally. Somebody's got to have these tools. If you're the leader, you have to have these tools. Thanks for today. It's only been about an hour, but I think we'll stop it at this point.